The biblical emblem for the church year season of Epiphany are the Magi. During this season, we have been celebrating the light of God radiating outward and revealing God's presence to more and more people, no matter their religious background, their cultural tradition, or national affiliation. We remember the journey of the Magi, the wise travelers, as one that we and others might share, whether we're guided by scholarship, careful observation, wonder, hope for a better world, or all of the above. The spirit of the Magi, it seems to me, is particularly present in Catherine Crouch, a physicist and a follower of Jesus, who, when she was recorded speaking to a community of faith about why she became a scientist, said that for her, it's all about wonder and delight. We have a short little video clip here revealing her enthusiasm. Here we go.
So I became a scientist because over and over, when I was a child, a teenager, a college student, I experienced the sheer delight of understanding the amazing physical mechanisms that are at work in our universe. Delight because the world is understandable, but also because it's so amazingly simple. So here we are, we've got these tiny dewdrops far behind them, so far away that they're just blurry in this photograph, are flowers. But there are these perfect images of the flowers that can be seen in the dewdrops. Why are they there? Well, we can explain those images completely with just two simple ideas. One is that light travels in straight lines until it comes to the boundary between the air around the dewdrops and the water that forms the drops. And the other is that the light slows down in the water, so it has to bend. Now, in fairness, it takes me 2 50-minute periods of my introductory physics course to actually work out the details of how you get from those two ideas to those images. And I don't have 100 minutes this morning, so I'm not going to. And some of you are probably relieved that I'm not going to. But the fact remains, those two simple principles determine not only these images, but also the workings of our vision, cameras, telescopes, you name it. And then even more remarkably, it turns out that not only light, but also magnetism and electricity all come from a single founding principle.
I can imagine that the Magi of the Bible were equally excited from their childhoods onward by seeing, questioning, learning, understanding, and then seeing anew with heightened appreciation and further questions. When a bright and moving star began at some deep level to beckon to them, they jumped at the chance to see where it might lead. It was in their nature to want to go and find out. We know from the Gospel according to Matthew that the Magi reached the high point of their journey when they knelt before the Christ child in reverence and adoration. Matthew chapter 2 describes their emotions and their actions. When they saw that the star had stopped, they were overwhelmed with joy. On entering the house, they saw the child with Mary, his mother. They knelt down and paid him homage. Then opening their treasure chests, they offered him gifts of gold, frankincense, and myrrh. And after that, we get just one more sentence about the Magi. Having been warned in a dream not to return to Herod, they left for their own country by another road. As today is the last Sunday of the 7 weeks during which our goal has been to invite science into conversation with religious faith, it seems like a good time to think about what the Magi took with them or how they might have changed as they headed for home. The Magi reached their destination and then they returned to their own country. What had they seen? What had they learned? How were they different? Probably at the moment of their departure, it was too soon to tell. My guess actually is that the meaning of their experience took a long time to work itself out in their lives. This may seem like too humble a comparison, but consider, if you will, the example of Stuart Bartram. Stuart calls himself an old man now, but he has a very vivid memory of something that happened, something that he saw as a child in a worship context that has stayed with him for his whole life. That something was a caterpillar. Young Stuart was sitting in the meeting house of his family's faith tradition, as he did on most Sundays, and on this particular Sunday, he noticed a caterpillar crawling across the floor. As far as he could tell, none of the adults had noticed it, and at first Stuart was quite worried about what would happen to this little creature when everyone got up and started walking around. But as time stretched out, and Stuart kept his gaze on the furry-looking creature, he saw that the caterpillar was making its way steadily into the distance. He watched, he says, until beyond the circle of persons, it was gone. Decades later, Stuart is still thinking about this encounter with the caterpillar. I know creatures are always passing, but ordinarily I know it only by way of a brief intersect, he reflects. From this occasion, the caterpillar and I had time, and I watched. The quality of his observing and connecting with a crawling critter seems significant to Stuart because, in retrospect, it helps him learn how important it is to be still, to pay attention to what's right before our eyes, to honor the life in other beings, to wait for insight or for the necessary thing to happen. He was not particularly aware of learning those lessons at the time, but now looking back and realizing that the memory still moves him, it helps him to explain why he still goes to worship and what is the substance for which he is hoping and waiting. Perhaps it was similar with the Magi. Perhaps in later years, they tried to describe to others what it was like to gaze at the face of Christ, tried to explain how Christ's truth and love seemed to speak to them still. Biologist Edward Osborne Wilson is another example that I might suggest of someone who may give us an inkling of what later life was like for the Magi after they went home from their experience in Bethlehem. When Wilson was just starting his career in science, he studied the social behavior of ants. He learned a lot from ants, including ways of thinking about evolution. His studies of ants made him quite famous. And then over the years, as time went on and he expanded his studies, he's written a whole number of books on a wide variety of biology topics and evolution topics, and he's become an extremely influential thinker. But he remains quite willing to give credit where credit is due. Ants are always there, and this has given me an edge, he said not long ago to a reporter. I've ridden ants the whole way. At age 82, you might think that Wilson would be happily retired, but he's not. He's busy with research and rainforest preservation in the Gorongosa Park in Mozambique, research on some rare ants that live in Yosemite, and research in the South Pacific. In Africa, his research partners include children. Limited time and budget constraints for surveying the diversity in the rainforest, the diversity of insect and reptile and small animal species, required some creative solutions. Ordinarily, a team of professional scientists would be assembled to do such a survey, but that was not feasible. And so instead, they gathered school children from the local area. These children were assembled, given Ziploc-style bags, and told to go into the forest and bring back anything that moved. Wow, Wilson remarked later, surrounded by excited kids and a huge pile of bags containing an amazing array of different critters. Wow, this is the way to make a real collection. Wilson's newest book, to be released a month or two from now, proposes rejecting a long-standing principle of evolution called kin selection in favor of a pair of rival forces that he proposed be called group selection, which favors altruism, and individual selection, which favors selfishness. The implication of this theory would be that our repertoire of behavior from a biological perspective includes much more than just competition. Controversy has already been ignited in advance of publication, but Wilson's ready for it. He feels confident in his theory and his interpretations. Also, apparently, he loves debate. He continues to find joy in new discovery, and he's hopeful, at least some of the time, that we humans might grow increasingly willing to use the discoveries of science to make intelligent choices about how to preserve the health of our planet. Maybe the Magi, too, based on the solid foundation of their early experience as they gained experience following a star, navigating a political minefield, and presenting their very best gifts to one whose presence promised a hopeful transformation of the human heart and human community, also went on to further exploration, teaching, writing, or even advocacy for how the world could be. Maybe the liveliness infused in them from beholding Christ Jesus remained infectious and drew children and adults alike to want to spend time with them and learn from them. Maybe the legacy of the Magi is akin to the one expressed in this poem written by Christopher Fowler, as he anticipated that one day he, like all of us, would have to face death. He wrote, "At that time, let me think of Dad, who said he preferred the nighttime to the day because it removed the blue dome overhead, the illusion that we were all isolated individuals, that this was all there is, and instead revealed the vast, majestic order of which we had truly been a part." I think it's safe to conclude that the learned travelers who followed a star to the one they meant to worship knew that they had been part of something vast and majestic. And I think it would be consistent with scriptural teaching to expect that a moment of illumination or a glimpse of glory cannot be grasped all in an instant. You heard me tell the children the story of Jesus' transfiguration on a mountaintop. Perhaps you noticed that as the disciples and Jesus came down the mountain, Jesus instructed them not to talk about their experience right away. "For now, tell no one about it," he said. And that's because he knew that the mountaintop experience would need to be interpreted in light of other experiences, in particular the crucifixion and the resurrection, before it could all make sense. In the same way, it would not be surprising if it took quite some time after their return home before the Magi were able to feel they had any kind of comprehensive picture of what they had seen, done, and experienced. And the same is no doubt true for us. If there have been insights from this time of deliberate focus on the methods and the wisdom of scientists, it may well take time for them to reach their full fruition in us and in our community. And if we did learn anything, the Bible encourages us to remember that the credit is not ultimately to us or to any scientist or scholar, but to God. As 2 Corinthians chapter 4, verses 6 and 7 put it, "It is the God who said, 'Let light shine out of darkness,' who has shone in our hearts to give the light of the knowledge of the glory of God in the face of Jesus Christ. And we have this treasure in clay jars, earthen vessels, so that it may be made clear that this extraordinary power belongs to God and does not come from us." Catherine Crouch is eloquent on this point as well. And so we're going to watch a second clip in which you're going to hear her talking about the risks of the journey, the importance of having an identity based on the love of God rather than on something as ephemeral as success, and the fact that any accomplishment or level of understanding we are blessed to enjoy is ultimately a gift from God. And so here we are with the second.
Now, doing scientific research demands risk. Some of the time, we have the tremendous satisfaction of uncovering relatively simple truths. But a lot of the time, it simply doesn't work at all. And I can bet you that even though you have no idea what that graph shows, you can tell that that one didn't work. If we knew it would work, it wouldn't be research. To answer any scientific question, there's an endless array of experiments we could do, data analysis we could perform, directions we could pursue. We always have to choose what to do. And there's always the danger that we'll choose ineffectively and we'll spend our time and resources going down one of those blind alleys that my mentor told me about. Even though experience hones our judgment, even those who are highly accomplished don't always get it right. I was recently talking with a Christian friend of mine who's a rising star in bioengineering. A year before he is up for tenure at his leading university, he has already doubled the benchmark number of research articles he's expected to publish. Now, I congratulated him on his success, and he said, "You know, Catherine, I'm having a lot of fun, but that's because my faith gives me confidence that my life does not depend on the success of my work. Honestly, I don't know how anyone who isn't a believer does this." Doing any kind of creative work, not just science, carries the risk of failure. But I wonder whether that's because creativity is an essential part of what God has made us to do. And the risk involved reminds us that it's ultimately our Father who gives fruit to anything that we do. It's easy to think that our ideas are our own, that the work of our hands, that our labors are our own. And the risk involved reminds us that they are a gift.
Over and over again, I've heard that same theme from a variety of scientists. Science is hard work. It's hard to get your work funded. Lab work and field research can be lonely, in part because it seems like not very many people seem to know or appreciate what you're doing. Risk of failure is always high. You have to be extremely self-motivated. At the same time, I've heard scientists say that the rigor of their work, the challenge, and the discipline required are all part of what makes science attractive to them. Also, that the rewards, when they come, even if they are few and far between, that thrill of discovery, of actually learning, showing, or proving something is extremely satisfying. The same, I think, can be said for the life of faith. A life of faith requires discipline, focus, and strong motivation. It can involve obstacles and pitfalls and being misunderstood. It can feel lonely at times. But the rewards that come from persisting and pursuing are treasures of great value. Hopefully, for at least some of us, the practice of science and the practice of faith might feel a little bit less lonely since we have engaged this conversation between the two during these past few weeks. I dare to imagine that having begun to talk in this vein, we might find some ways to continue. In any case, certainly we can all feel free to take courage in the God who makes light shine out of darkness. As Carl Sagan explained 3 or 4 decades ago, and as scientists continue to verify, the universe is mostly darkness, and light is comparatively rare. And yet, as the Gospel of John affirms, the light shines in the darkness, and the darkness did not overcome it. Whether heading for home or for the next great adventure, we go on in the strength of God's light. Magnificent God, we thank you for all the possibility that you put before us. May we live into the future with you, trusting that as we journey with your Spirit, following whatever light you give us, we will be led where we most need to go. And as we pray this morning, O God, we hold in our hearts all those who have traveled the road before us and who've been so important in preparing our way. We welcome those who have only recently arrived to join us in the adventure of life and of discipleship on the way. And we bless those who keep moving, even though they may be suffering, just as we rejoice with those whose faith has been strengthened by your grace in the midst of both happy and sorrowful events. Grant us courage, O God, for the living of our days. We join our voices now in praying the prayer that Jesus taught us. Our Father, who art in heaven, hallowed be thy name. Thy kingdom come, thy will be done, on earth as it is in heaven. Give us this day our daily bread, and forgive us our trespasses, as we forgive those who trespass against us. Lead us not into temptation, but deliver us from evil. For thine is the kingdom, and the power, and the glory forever. Amen.